Well, hello. Welcome along to Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Welcome along for the cinematic ride, where every week we take a dive into a conversation about film, TV and music. Sometimes it's deep, real deep. Other times it's a bit more surface level. But whatever it is, whatever that conversation takes us, I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoy doing those interviews, because I love it. Got some great stuff on the way. In fact, I'm recording this having just spoken to Neil Sora, who is the son of the wonderful Ryuichi Sakamoto, who died almost a year ago. But in kind of celebration of his father, and one of his father's last wishes was to do one last concert, which Neil filmed. It's called Opus, and it's coming out at the end of the month. And so I'm absolutely beyond thrilled that I've had the opportunity to speak to Neil about his beautiful film and talk to him about his dad and his dad's music and his creativity and collaboration. So that is on the way, my friends. But our latest guest on Soundtracking is Isa Lopez. She is creator, writer and director of the latest series of True Detective. It's called True Detective Night Country, which is available to watch in its entirety on Sky and Now TV, in the UK anyway, HBO in the States and others in other places. Starring Jodie Foster and Kali Reese, it's set in a remote Alaskan town during the winter spell of perpetual darkness and follows an investigation into the mysterious disappearance of eight men at a research station. The visuals are absolutely stunning. The performances are stunning. The music is stunning, as well as boasting a suitably chilling score by Vince Pope. It also features a range of incredible needle drops. And with this in mind, there's really only one place that we should start, and that's with Billie Eilish's title track, Bury a Friend.
What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know? Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me? When we all fall asleep, where do we go?
Come here.
Say it, spit it out. What is it exactly? Your pain is the amount cleaning you out. Am I satisfactory? Today I'm thinking about the things that are deadly. The way I'm drinking you down, like I wanna drown, like I wanna end me. Step on the glass, staple your tongue. Bury a friend, try to wake up. Cannibal class, killing the sun. Bury a friend, I wanna end me.
Isa, lovely to chat to you. Thank you for being here, and congratulations on this phenomenal series. I haven't seen the last episode yet, and I can't wait. I felt like I didn't breathe for the last 20 minutes of episode 5.
Right?
It's just so great.
I know. We knew, you know, even from a script, when I decided what was going to happen in that last cliffhanger, I was like, this is going to be yummy. And it was interesting, but honestly just kept getting better and better by draft to draft. And then when the actors came on board, just the improvising and the work we did together to elevate it, it just became what you saw.
Yeah. Wow. That's so great in terms of the freedom and the journey that you give it. It's great. I want to talk about music with you.
Yes.
If that's okay.
Because
this has got, music's got such a brilliant identity within
you.
This show. The Billie Eilish track, but then all the other music and the score that's in there as well. What was that journey of deciding how the show would sound? The Billie track, I feel, kind of just gives it a real stamp of kind of coolness, intrigue, mystery. It's a great kind of starting point almost.
Yes, what happened is, you know, when I saw True Detective, the first one, it has such a, that intro, those title sequence is in itself extraordinary. And now we're used to seeing a lot of double exposure stuff, but it started with them. And it said everything. It talked about characters who held worlds inside themselves. Mm. So how do you top that? And the song was perfect. The lyrics didn't match the events on the series or the characters, but the feeling did seamlessly. So from the beginning, when I started talking to music supervisors, I was like, welcome. We have two issues. One is Twist and Shout, welcome to this world. And the other one is we need a title song that is going to create such a stamp At the beginning, I imagined that it was going to be the same kind of broken blues. I wanted it in a female voice because the series was moving in that direction. However, we tried so many incredible songs and nothing gave me the femaleness, the spunk, the darkness, the playfulness, the mystery. I was looking for something very specific. The one that got very close to being that was the On Thanks. Once for Sorrow, you know, which I use in episode one and to great effect. And I finished the episode. The end credits work with that.
Once for sorrow, tears for joy. Three's for a girl and four's for a boy. Five's for silver, six for gold. Seven's for a secret never told. Devil, devil, I defy thee. Devil, devil, I defy thee. Devil, devil, I defy thee.
But we couldn't find that song. So I went back to the playlist, which I often do, that I use when I wrote the show. And I wrote this in the darkest night of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I was listening night and day to Billie Eilish. And there was a reason. And there was, and I think they informed, her albums informed the feeling of the series. And there was that particular song that felt that every line in the lyrics alluded to an event in the series. It's uncanny. To the point that I've been asked, did you write the series inspired in the song? Because I know she didn't write the song inspired in the series. But they feel made for each other. And with that in mind, we tried it. And it was a no-brainer. It just, you go inside the series, you go inside the events, and every time that you are at the deepest in the beginning, boom, Billie comes and sets a tone. So it's just as dark and just as full of ghosts as that first song was in the first season, but it's a completely different song in a completely different genre. And I thought it was a really nice way to say, this is that. But at the same time, it's not.
It's perfect. It's so interesting you talking about the pandemic, because I was listening to you talk about when you were researching the location and you couldn't physically go there. So you were listening to radio stations up there.
Yes.
And I find that really fascinating as a way of you getting into the community, the environment, the people as well. Because I love radio. I think radio is such a great medium. What did you take from listening to the radio of that kind of location?
The first thing you notice is that there are such small communities that it is a network. You know, people say hello and everybody is not like our radio that when they say it's happy birthday to so-and-so, who's so-and-so? I don't know who so-and-so is. Here, you know. And then in the next song, they answer. So it is a network. And the songs are oldies, most of them, not all of them, but it has this nostalgic idea of a world begun that I think informs the series in a way. And then there was a particular episode when I was, a particular moment when I was writing episode one, and Smokey Robinson was singing, and I put it there, you know, when Rose is gutting the wolf, I did put Smokey Robinson on her. You know, it took away from the silence of the tundra, and to my sadness, I ended up taking Smokey Robinson out. But after Smokey Robinson played in KTVU radio, the presenter, because you know, like when I was in KTVU, actually, power goes out often. Wi-Fi goes out often. And so the guy is like, here we are, Christmas is coming. and we're taking calls. And then the guy went, hello, 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 is anybody there? And I was like, oh, this has to be in the series. This sense of, as Rose says, the fabric of things is coming apart and the voices get lost in there. So I took it from the local radio.
Wow, that's amazing. tingles from that. That's so extraordinary. Uh-huh. Do you remember a show called Northern Exposure?
Of course.
That was that. That's that kind of thing where it's talking directly to the community. I mean, he was in the street talking to people as well. But yeah, that's
It's a massive reference. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Northern Exposure was partly or totally right by David Chase, who went on to make a little show called Sopranos.
Yeah.
It's interesting, right?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Totally. And then you have all these wonderful other great choices of existing music, but there are most of them anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm so involved in the show that you kind of go, oh yeah, that's, and write it down. But a lot of them are cover versions of original songs as well. So you have that Marika Hackman track in there as well. Likey Lee's done it as mm-hmm. well. So all those kind of, it's so clever because you recognise the song, but you might not necessarily recognise who's singing that version. And I love that about it because it adds to that level of, what am I thinking? Yeah. Where are,
dislocation.
Yeah, it's great.
You know, distance is that thing, but it feels different. Mm. And it adds to the eeriness. I do love taking a cheery song and making it into a heartbreaking piece. Yeah. It was particularly hard with Twist and Shout, you know, but we were very successful in the end.
Yeah.
So, yes, it was an intention of Miley Cyrus heartbreak song, but done in a way that talks about end of life.
I heard you on the phone last night. We live and die by pretty lies. You know it. We both know it. Your silver bullet cigarette. Burning house, there's nothing left. It's smoking. We both know it. We got all night to fall in love, but just like that we fall apart. We're broken. We're broken. Nothing, nothing, nothing gonna save us now.
So yes, the covers were kind of a mission. When the original didn't completely feel the series, but the lyrics did, but the underlying feelings did, we went for a cover.
And then what were your conversations with Vince with regards to, you know, kind of working with those sounds of those pieces that you've chosen, mm-hmm. with the story, with the characters, with the tone, and getting that score right? Because it works so brilliantly.
Yeah, sometimes we took the last feeling of the song and picked it up with a mm-hmm. score, you know, to make it, the creating a single sound escape was a mission throughout the series. If you read my scripts, you're going to see the song's name there. Not all of them, but many of them are named there. And so the actors would listen to them and then we play them in the scene and then took the music off because it's not going to work. But the feeling of the song is in the scene. And the sound design is in the script. Any script of mine, but specifically Night Country, because of the dark, sound becomes everything. And you can feel that sound design and the whispers and the wailing, which marries perfectly with the sounds of throat singing. And how to incorporate those elements into a delicate contemporary soundtrack, original soundtrack that Vince did. That I have collaborated in my previous project in Tigers Are Not Afraid, which is similar in feeling, I think, you know, it happens in a very different place. But it's a world that is surrounded by presences and absences. And how does that sound? And I didn't know Vince when I made Tigers. I was looking for that feeling in a score. And I'm an absolute nerd about composers. And we listened to, for that movie, for so many of them, I couldn't find the sound I was looking for. And then I got a very bad cold and I was in bed and I watched Dark Mirror, and an episode of it came on. And the moment I heard the score, I was like, that's the sound. Who is this guy? His name is Vince Pope. He's in England. I'm making a movie in Mexico. Talked to my Mexican music supervisor and said, you need to contact this man and tell him that we don't have enough money, but we have a movie that he might like.
Yeah.
And we sent it, and he was so surprised about a Mexican movie, watched it, loved it, created the score, and the work together was seamless. And because True Detective Night Country has a similar feeling,
yeah,
it felt like a natural continuation of our work. He knows how to give voice to the eeriness of my stories.
Some of your influences and inspirations growing up as a child, and mm-hmm. and that very world that you're talking about, and how, forgive me for being presumptuous, but going back to a beautiful story you told about your father and Fanny and Alexander,
yeah,
and that almost feels like it started that fascination with that.
Well, it's so funny that you brought up my father into this, because He was a man of passions, and one of them was cooking, which I miss terribly. One of them was cinema, and the other one was music. And a lot of people of my generation are going to say, oh, my dad listened to rock and roll and Sinatra and, you know, and the crooners or jazz. No, my dad was classical music, yeah, and he was an absolute, absolute connoisseur. So I grew up listening to opera and knowing areas of... He had an obsession with Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov. And, you know, the Russians were a thing for him, interestingly. And all opera, basically, and knowing the plot and knowing the areas. And he personally met Stravinsky. You know, he was so obsessed with it that when Stravinsky visited Mexico, he made a point of going, and he had an autograph record. So classical music was the soundtrack of my childhood. It was 24/7, as he was an academic. He would work on his writing, and it was 24/7 classical music. So when I was 5, he would bring me down to parties at the home, and he would play a certain movement of a certain thing, and I would go like, that's Dvorak, you know. I was that little parrot of music. So with surprises,
wonderful education.
It was. I'm illiterate in the, we say illiterate in Spanish, I think. I don't have the language of music, meaning I can't read music, I can't play music, which is one of the saddest sides of my life, but I learned other arts, but I understand music. So when I talk to composers, they're always like, oh, you know exactly, and the references are there. Yeah. Now, as my father was playing classical music, I was rebelling, obviously, and listening to everything from, well, I developed a very, very massive obsession with David Bowie and with Aha.
Me too.
Like Morten Harkett,
I
hottest
saw them live
man ever
when
born.
I was about 10, and it was life-changing.
Yeah. So it was a mix of Aha and Stravinsky, you know. But that informs, as you can see, that informs the way that I create music for shows.
And did that also happen when you started watching film, in appreciation of how that music was used in that storytelling form?
Oh my God, completely. Completely. It was the magic of listening to Barbier, Adagio in Platoon. Because the contrast of absolute perfect, gorgeous music with absolute horror, every single time that music became a counterpoint of what was happening. And the soundtracks, when I had a massive collection of soundtracks, we were so broke that all the money in that household went into records, books, extraordinary delicatessen food, but we couldn't play for shoes, you know.
Priorities, so, I like
yes,
it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so, I love that story that you told about wanting to watch, was it Alien and The Shining? Yeah, and then your dad was kind of like, yeah, you can watch that, but you've got to watch one that I choose. And it's really interesting as well hearing you talk about how much you're a fan of storytelling and talking about, you know, Jodie's character in this. And I heard her do an interview. She talked about, wouldn't it be really interesting if this was actually kind of where Clarice ended up, kind of, you know, in terms of the fact that she's played a, you know, seen her back in that kind of genre, very, very different and very different character. But how there's almost a pull through of that kind of films that have started the ball rolling in certain things. So whether it be Silence of the Lambs, Seven, you know, in terms of the things that have inspired you along the way. Is that fair to say?
It does feel a little bit, you know, like the oranges that appear in the show. It feels like all those movies and all those past, all that past has been throwing an orange that has gone through my filmic work, and I caught it in this one, you know, which is a beautiful thing to catch the messages that your child fan sends you. I'm sitting there watching her doing the Silence of the Lambs and thinking, I don't even know what to do with it, because I thought I was going to be an archaeologist. I went into archaeology school, but I was a filmmaker. I just didn't know it. And the emotions that provoked in me that I couldn't contain in the movie theater, and I carried for weeks, and I had to go back to the Church of Cinema to experience it again. What was I going to do with that?
Yeah.
And it took decades to finally answer myself and put it in Night Country.
So nice to think that you're doing something for yourself within this as well as everybody else who's watching it.
I do feel that filmmakers often write letters to themselves. And we're so worried about telling a story for everybody that often we forget to listen as Navarro hears, listen. And I think that those are messages that we send ourselves, you know? And listen to what you're saying to yourself in the story that you see on the screen. And if it affects you, if you receive it, often it affects other people. Because we're not that different, you know? For some people it was oranges, for some people it was classical music, for some people it was reggae, for some people it was, you know, mom cooked. We all lost someone. We all miss something. And in the end, Night Country is about the things we lost along the way and we miss. But we can't bear to look back and embrace them.
It's such a layered show in terms of, you know, you come to a true detective series and you think you know what you're getting. And what I've loved about watching this is with every episode and with every performance and relationship in there, there's so many layers and surprises. I can't comprehend how you wrote that.
Well, I have an essential principle in everything I write. And I learned that from John August, who is an incredibly generous writer working in Hollywood, not only a brilliant writer, but a brilliant teacher. He was not my teacher, but he has a podcast and he's ready to tell everybody how to do this. Not in a insufferable way, but like, listen, I've done this for a while, so here's a little advice. And he has 11 brilliant points on how to write a scene, and I tend to forget them. But there's one of them that for me is my absolute cred, and it is surprise. You know, once you decide how a scene, you know what has to happen in a scene, mm-hmm. you know? It's a machine, so you have to go from A to B, and to get to B, you have to do this thing in the middle, where X character has to learn this, do that. And you can do that scene like that. You know, there's two characters, they talk about it, you got the information, you move. Now, the question is, how do you make it surprising? Not only the reveal, not only the information, but what are the characters doing? Where are they? What about it is going to be surprising? And if you keep that in mind, in tiny, tiny ways, little surprises and then big surprises, the show is going to connect, is going to feel fresh.
When you have this kind of powerhouse, like someone like Jodie coming in as well with Carly, they're so fantastic together on screen, and they really kind of bring out the best in each other. And like you said at the very start of our conversation, in terms of, you know, you write the script, but then the actors, then you give them the opportunity to play with it, to improvise with it as well. What's that like for you to kind of see what you've created kind of elevated even further through their interpretation, their craft, their ability?
Well, it's such a joy because you work with two very, very different actors, two very, very different people. And they have very different tools that come from very different experience to convey truth. Because all you're looking for is the moment when the line stops being a line and becomes something that someone real said in a real room. That's the magic. So to get there, they each have their tools. So as a director, when you meet them and when you have a rehearsal, the thing you need to do is understand what that tool is for you to be able to help them use it. So you have a performer like Jodie, who her tool is herself. All of her is the tool because her first memory is on a set. She was 3 years old. Like, her first memory in life is on a set. So for her, the tool, there's no tool. That's her. And you explain to her where the character is exactly, and she understands it because she also has been reading scripts forever. So she understands it, and you create a dialogue where you go like, yes, but also this. And she goes, yes, I'm going to use, yes. And gets excited and uses it. So it comes from the intellectual understanding that then she just makes it into herself and makes truth. And then you work with Kaylee. And Kaylee, though, she's incredibly cerebral. The thing that will bring down that understanding to her body is emotion. So with Kaylee, you go to the other side of the ring and you go, yeah, he doesn't want you, he hates you, you know, and you work from the emotions and she connects with you, you know, you hold her hands. I think this comes also from working with coaches that go like, you had us. It's a lot more emotional. And that will let her put it in her body. And you can see it in her eyes when she hits it. And you go, keep it. And Jodie's ready. And then you say action and they go. And it doesn't matter the technique or the tool. Truth is truth.
Yeah.
And then you see it happen. And that's a satisfaction.
Wow, it's like a boxing ring.
Well, yes. You know, I don't think it's by chance that I picked a boxer to do this.
Do you think Denver's listens to music?
Oh, no. She would die.
Yeah.
She used to, as we know, she used to dance. She used to play the Beatles to her baby. Mm-hmm. But if she listens to music now, it will open the door of that past. So what she listens to is white noise. To stop the music. She can't bear the music. It will break her.
Life would be so sad if we had to do that,
wouldn't
it?
Oh, it's a sad life. Did you see her house? It's a sad apartment.
Yeah. I have to mention as well the wonderful Fiona Shaw, who...
That woman.
Oh, my God. I mean, just... She can do anything.
She can do anything.
Everything and anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. True yeah. superhero.
I kind of feel like, I mean, I haven't seen the last episode, so I'm not sure what Rose...
Oh, you're going to see a different Rose.
Am I? Okay,
six.
I was about to say, to say I need more.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing with regards to kind of working with the characters and the actors on those characters, sorry, is that how much do they help inform or shift things in any way, shape or form? You know, you have the script and the structure for those episodes, but... You know, is there an opportunity for their interpretation of...
Oh, all the opportunity. I am my favorite thing to do on a set is reread a scene that we agreed on. We liked, the studio approved, we're happy, we rehearsed, and get to set and go like, this is shit. And I don't know who wrote it, and I don't know if I had one too many ambience that night, but look at this. And then I crumble it, send it away, and go like, what happens here? If there's a line that we love, let's keep it. If not, let's go for it. I love it.
That's so great. And I loved hearing you talk about, you know, Reykjavik doubling up as you know, the Arctic because of so many reasons. But Reykjavik comes with a great music scene.
Oh, the best music scene in the world. The best music scene in the world, you know. Here's the thing. Reykjavik is a country with an incredible education system, the Scandis. 10% of the population is a published writer. And every single person studies music in a school, like not the way we do with a little flute or a trombone or, you know, or a band. They study music and chorus. Choral music is a massive tradition. So everybody has a voice and they just get together and sing and create and they collaborate because there's no... It's such a small community that there's no competition. There's no superstars, though there are the Bjorks of it, the Johan Johanssons, exist. Yeah. But however, they all work together. Bjork and Johansson, when he was alive, all of them dedicated their lives to bring other Icelanders up. So it's a community of musicians all collaborating. And like in every collaboration, the quality, which is great, just elevates.
Yeah. It's funny, I've spoken to a few, Hilde Gunnlottir and Adley Overson as well, and his score for Silo was just incredible,
right?
So great. Uh-huh. And there is something really special about creativity that comes out of Iceland, I think, in particular in music. And they were telling me that there's a, you know, kind of the government have committed to within, you know, every child has the opportunity to study music.
Yes.
Like you say, it's like, wow.
Yes.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
As a Mexican who would never expect it, I seriously consider moving to Iceland, you know, whether or not. It is a utopia, except for the volcanoes.
Yeah.
Except for the volcanoes and the hidden people. They're absolutely sure that they have hidden people. And I But you can talk to the most serious intellectual, scientific, you know, down to drinks, they will start talking about the hidden people. They're very serious about it.
Oh, I need to know more about hidden people.
Yes. I mean, go and Google that stuff.
That's where I'm going now. What are you taking from this to the next project, do you think?
Oh, my God. It sounds super like part of an ego trip, but it was Barry Jenkins who told me, because he had shot The Underground Railroad and a movie that got an Oscar, and another beautiful movie that was nominated for an Oscar. And then he directed every episode of The Underground Railroad, which is a very challenging series. And when I finished, we had a drink in Reykjavik. And he said, girl, this is a very special thing. You're one now of a very, very exclusive club of the people that have written every episode and directed every episode of their own series. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very, very small group. And if you talk to any of us, and now you're one of us, you know now that there is nothing that you can't shoot. And I hadn't even thought about it. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, I am scared of nothing as a filmmaker. And he told me, like, people would think that it's Moonlight, like the essential thing that made me a filmmaker. It was The Underground Railroad. And I feel the same.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Thank you, Isa.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I want to add very quickly the importance in the music of the Inuit people and the throat singing.
Yeah.
Tanya Tagaq, who is an international rock star and a punk musician, and she has a voice that can go anywhere. It's truly insane. And she's genius, and she composed additional music for the show. And then with her, we had a group of Varna, Nancy, Charlotte, incredible, top-level, world-level throat singers that created the atmosphere and the sound, both for the sound design, all the grumblings and mumblings and whispers and callings are there, but also the music. And the sound of the show wouldn't be what it is without their voice.
And the human voice adds something different as well, doesn't it?
Yes.
I don't know, it penetrates in a way that that an instrument doesn't.
Doesn't. Yeah. And it is female.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Thank you.
From the score to True Detective Night Country, that's Annie Arroyes. Featuring the vocals of those singers Isa Lopez mentioned, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin'. My huge thanks to Isa for taking the time to talk to me. I absolutely loved that chat. As I said, True Detective Night Country is available to watch in full on Sky and Now TV. See, I thought I would wait till the entire series was available because it's one of those ones that you're going to want to binge. If you'd like to hear my chats with Hilda or indeed the aforementioned wonderful Barry Jenkins, head to edithbowman.com where you can also find every single episode of the podcast. Soundtrackin' UK is the place to hook up with us on our socials, and we have a YouTube channel too, which we'd love you to subscribe to and get involved in the conversation and dive into many of the videos that we have up there. Next up then, very excited to share my chat with Neil Soro talking about his father Ryuichi Sakamoto and that film that they made together. It's called Opus. Neil Soro, my guest on next week's episode, I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.